It helps us a bit to adapt, of course, as we have production in US and Europe, but then we need to remember that in our type of industry, like steel, we are also coping with the biggest issue, which is the enormous subsidized overcapacity in Asia. And there are, of course, a lot of industries that have disappeared from Europe because of that. And now that is the reason why we are getting the new safeguards now in the summer to make sure that the critical strategic industry like steel stays in Europe. Europe needs it for its autonomy, for defense industry. Europe needs it for the infrastructure, for the car industry. And that would be a really bad decision from Europe if we would let the melt capacity be totally in Asia and Europe dependent on it. It's a bit like energy, what we're discussing now. Europe has become too dependent on others, and we need to make sure that we are not so dependent.
Welcome to Leaders Unplugged, real talk with the impactful. I'm David Bach, your host. Today, our guest is Kati ter Horst. In October 2024, she took over as president and CEO of Outokumpu, the global leader in sustainable stainless steel, headquartered in Helsinki, Finland, after having served on its board for a decade. In her previous roles, including at Stora Enso, Kati gained deep experience in manufacturing, sustainability, and large-scale transformation. Kati is part of the IMD CEO community. She recently shared the stage with my colleague Howard Yu at the Nordic Business Forum. We covered a lot of ground in this conversation, from comparing notes as first-time CEOs to Europe's competitiveness, the energy transition, and the future of trade. Plus, she told me why making time for sauna is really important. Here's my conversation with Kati ter Horst. Kati ter Horst, welcome to Leaders Unplugged.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So tell us a little bit about Outokumpu. You're the global leaders in sustainable stainless steel. What does that mean?
But first of all, I guess the leadership position means we are number one in Europe and number two in the US. And then when we refer to sustainability, we have 75% lower carbon footprint than the industry average. And it basically comes from three things. One is that we are scrap-based. Our recycled material content is higher than 95%. We have our own chromium mine. So the ferrochrome that makes steel stainless, that's what we produce ourselves. And then we have quite a high share of renewable electricity being a Nordic company.
So where do we find your products? Where would people encounter them?
Oh, many places. You would find it in a drum of a washing machine. Could be some of the home appliances that you see the beautiful stainless steel around you. Some of the most beautiful bridges. You could say Chrysler Building in the US, where you need to see the beautiful steel and it can't actually get corrosed over the time. So those would be typical cars you see our steel. Many of the industrial machines you see our steel. In knives and forks, in pans. So in your everyday life, you see the stainless steel.
You joined Outokumpu from Stora Enso. So that's a company is very much about wood. And you spoke about steel just now with a certain aesthetic and passion. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, have you developed a real appreciation for the beauty of steel?
No, absolutely. I think it's a fantastic product. It's a durable product, lasting more than 100 years in many of the applications. So, and it has fantastic look and feel. And that's why we also say in Outokumpu that we are contributing the world that lasts forever. I think that's fantastic. But, you know, if you compare to wood, for instance, also cross-laminated timber in the wooden buildings, they also last 100 years. So the same. So there are a lot of similarities as well, but I like materials and when you can make them, you know, look at the beautiful buildings in New York where you have stainless steel facades. You can't say that they are not beautiful. They are like fantastic or beautiful bricks. Of course, architecture and design plays a role, not just the material.
You've been at the helm of the company as president and CEO for about 18 months or so since October 2024. I'm sure it's been a bit of a bumpy, interesting ride. A lot of things have happened over the past 18 months. What are some of your reflections?
So I started indeed in October 24. And I think in the beginning of 25, like in many industries, we all thought like, okay, finally, we see the growth now coming in and times get better. And then the discussion on the tariff started, of course. And that created a lot of uncertainty. And I think also definitely slowed down the growth in global markets. And then we kind of felt a bit like, hey, the rules that we used to being a global company and trading, suddenly the rules are gone. Luckily then Outokumpu, that we have production both in Europe and the US. So that was of course helpful in that situation. But I think a lot of turbulence because of that. Other thing was that European steel industry, stainless and carbon industry have been suffering from very low demand in the past years. We had a lot of Asian overcapacity coming into the market. And then of course the fact that US put 50% tariffs made the situation even worse. So then last year, of course, we worked a lot with the commission, both on the rules for the CBAM that now started this year, and then the new safeguards that are coming this summer. So there was a lot of influencing and being involved in external factors, much more than I would have expected. So that was really the last year. And now I think beginning of this year, we again hoped for some good news. And then now we have the crisis in the Middle East, which is impacting all of us. Yeah.
We'll get back to some of these external challenges. And I've been in my role for a month longer than you have been in yours. So we're sort of on this journey together. And I sometimes get asked if the role of leading IMD is how I envisioned it. So I'm curious, is your role the way you envisioned it? In what way has it been that way? And in what way has it been different?
I think maybe the one surprise is that what are all the things you are asked about as a CEO? So, you know, like, because you kind of think that I should operate a bit of the high level. And I thought, like, as a CEO, I need to concentrate on, that's kind of my thing. You need to concentrate on the things that only the CEO can do. I'm trying to kind of remember that because there are a lot of people, of course, in organization, fantastic colleagues that I have that can take care of a lot of the things. So I'm trying to kind of follow that. But then there are, of course, situations you are the one who is the head figure to communicate about the company. There are certain tables, for instance, commission, if you invite it by Ursula von der Leyen on the table to discuss steel actions, then if you don't go there as a CEO, then there's no place for Outokumpu. So that those are some of the maybe the things that have bit like surprise, so you have to kind of learn how to work with that and how you delegate your time. Because that, I think, is the biggest thing, is that your calendar gets full very easily and you need to sometimes look at it and say that, are these the things that I should be really working on? Is this my role? Or do I need to actually shift gears a bit and put more time somewhere else and clear my calendar? So I think I've gotten better in that, but that was really a practice the first year. What should my calendar actually look like? What should I concentrate on?
I think that's a really, really valuable insight. And it's something that you don't really know until you do it. You have to sort of work with it in the moment.
Yeah, you have a plan, but your plan changes because things happen. So I think that's the, yeah. But you have to protect your time. I think that's definitely correct.
And you have a good team that helps you protect your time?
Absolutely. My executive assistant, Dina, is very good at that. So
very good. You were on the board of the company before you stepped into the CEO role. What has that been like? I mean, that's unusual to do it in that sequence.
It happens actually quite a lot in Scandinavia, or at least Finland. It has happened lately quite a lot. I think it's not the bad way. I think the other way it doesn't work, but I think it's not bad as long as you kind of feel that there is a continuation and that the decisions you've been supporting and made in the board, you are kind of still behind them. And then when you come in, you can have, of course, a new face, but it's not, you cannot become a CEO and say, look, I think everything we did and decided in the board in the past years was rubbish. You can't do that. You can't turn your jacket kind of becoming a CEO. But the good thing about that is you know the board members, you know the chairman, so you don't need to put so much time in getting to know the board and understanding how this board works. Then, of course, you have to remember that you are now in a new role. So you know, you are not the board member anymore. But I think that's a good thing. So I could, for instance, then put more time on investor relations, for instance. That was a bit of a new role for me as I'm a first-time CEO. So I think it has helped me. But then you also need to understand what you don't know. And I think the side of that is that you don't know the management that well. You gotten to know them as people a little bit. You've seen them present. But really how they work together, how are they as leaders, that you only learn to know when you are more hands-on with them. So I think it's important to recognize also what you don't know. You think you know, but you might not know.
It's interesting that you say it's been more common in Finland. And listening to you, it sounds like actually a really effective way of perhaps getting somebody accustomed with a company. I mean, is it a model that you would recommend for other places?
I think it's maybe the reason, I don't know exactly, but I would think the reason in Finland can be also that it's quite a small market in Finland. So that could be also one reason that that happens more often. But I think it's not necessarily a bad background. You've been already getting to know the company for a number of years. So it prepares you somehow, and you know what you are more going into, at least as a company strategy, the board. So I don't know what would be negative about that. I think the only thing probably is indeed that if you really feel like there needs to be a certain change and you've been a kind of silent board member and not really happy with the decisions, which I hope nobody is, then that would not be good, of course.
Right. But that has more to do with how you work as a board member as opposed to the fact that you're on the board.
Sure. And then, of course, if some owners or whatever in a situation really want a big change in company, then probably you wouldn't choose somebody from the board to lead the company.
You already mentioned how much time you've been spending on dealing with tariffs. You've said recently that free trade is gone. Mm. You're operating on both sides of the Atlantic. I mean, we've known that there were more protectionist tendencies, but still, the U.S. sort of turning away so decisively from free trade is a big change. How are you, how is your team, how is your organization adapting to this world?
Well, like I said, it helps us a bit to adapt, of course, as we have production in U.S. and Europe. But then we need to remember that in our type of industry, like steel, we are also coping with the biggest issue, which is the enormous subsidized overcapacity in Asia. And there are, of course, a lot of industries that have disappeared from Europe because of that. And now that is the reason why we are getting the new safeguards now in the summer to make sure that the critical strategic industry like steel stays in Europe. Europe needs it for its autonomy, for defense industry. Europe needs it for the infrastructure, for the car industry. And that would be a really bad decision from Europe if we would let the melt capacity be totally in Asia and Europe dependent on it. It's a bit like energy, what we're discussing now. Europe has become too, you know, dependent on others. And we need to make sure that we are not so dependent. So, and I think then it would not be realistic to think that we go back to free trade. I don't think that will happen. I'm absolutely a supporter of free trade. Outokumpu is that. But when the rules of the game have changed, then you need to make sure also your business that is based on sustainability and clear rules, code of conduct, that you can continue doing that business in the surroundings where you are. And then you need to react to things that are actually against it. And I think that's the situation we are now.
So fair trade is something that has become critically important. And of course, in the context of a need for more resilience and to some extent, a bit more autonomy, certainly in Europe.
Yeah, it's a level playing field if you want to look at it. So if Europe has and European companies invested a lot in green transition, for instance, so you cannot allow just other companies come to Europe and push the prices really down and compete on subsidized products and totally different carbon footprint. So that is, I think, what we're looking for, the level playing field, nothing else than that.
As you know, there are a lot of people who wonder whether Europe can be competitive in heavy industries, in steel, particularly while at the same time pursuing ambitious sustainability objectives. Can Europe compete?
We think Europe can compete. What is important, though, that now, for instance, when we want to go further with the green transition, it's important that the ETS system, for instance, that Europe has built, that stays, because it has direct impact then on a carbon price. And it's also important that the money that is gotten in with the CBAM and the ETS system is then invested back to the industry to help the industry further decarbonize. And that also helps then Europe to become more autonomous because you are not relying anymore so much on the fossils that we don't have here in Europe. So I think that's absolutely important for Europe. Maybe the sustainability world and, you know, the demand for sustainable products outside Europe maybe not on the highest right now. But I think everybody has to rethink in this situation again, what is their energy based on and what creates the long-term competitiveness. But Europe needs to step up also in the use of AI. Europe needs to step up absolutely in really creating a strong European home market. We have so many borders between the countries that are not the tariffs of Trump. They are other things. So I think that is definitely what we need to work on in Europe. And productivity is one. We are behind productivity. So there's also a lot to be done, absolutely.
But I like the way you frame this, right? Sustainability then in that context doesn't become a nice to have. It actually becomes part of this objective of greater resilience and greater autonomy, because it's nice to make it locally, but if you depend on imported energy, then you haven't really achieved that resilience and that autonomy. Yeah. So in that respect, the two of them go together.
Then I think we need to ask also, what do we want as Europeans? What do we value? And I would say Europeans still value clean air, clean water, all that. And I think therefore also as Europeans, we should maybe also have a bit more mentality, let's buy European.
Yeah. So you've already spoken about productivity, the need to bolster it, AI. Talk a little bit about the strategy that you've been working on for the company. And of course, that's not just about Europe, that's global. So I'm curious how the pieces fit together.
So indeed, as a new CEO, first thing you do, next strategy phase, what are we going to do? And it's a great way actually also to pull your team together and see who is strategic and who's not strategic. So we really made the strategy together with a management team, and that was launched in Capital Markets Day in the summer of 25. And our new strategy is called Evolve. And it was a bit looking forward and looking backwards, because Outokumpu is more than 110 years old company, started in mining in many different metals, then found chromium, went to stainless steel, and now we are one of the world's biggest players in stainless steel. So there's been a lot of evolving also in the past, and a lot of industries have developed around Outokumpu. So looking at that knowledge, which was very much based on metals and technology, we kind of said that, okay, we are big in stainless steel, but it's a very cyclical market. It doesn't really make sense for us to grow in that. We are big already, number one here in Europe and number two in the US. But what are really the opportunities for growth for us that would make the company less cyclical? We could use our technology, metal knowledge, and we could also find businesses with higher growth and higher margins. And what kind of fits us? Where can we win? So what is Outokumpu good at, and where are our strengths? And from that, then we said that, okay, the ferrochrome business that we've seen more as a domestic supplier to Outokumpu steel factories, why don't we give it the possibility really to become a full market player? And as we have the only chromium mine in the EU area, that is a good starting point, let's put it like that. So ferrochrome is an area where we're looking for growth through technology and through developing new products. And linked to that, we have been developing a quite mind-blowing proprietary technology in the US that could really change how we think about mining and how we can extract more metal actually out of the ore than you can in the traditional mining methods today. So it's very much on metals and technology. A nice thing about this new technology as well, that we would not need to add carbon into the process. So the metals would be almost, you could say, green metals. So that is really something we're really working on. And then on more specialty products, we've seen more growth in high nickel alloys that go to very demanding places in the world where you have very high temperature, very low temperature, a lot of pressure. So metal that has to, endure a lot. So that's another area where we are, where we're looking for growth. And then our foundational business, stainless steel, is the one concentrating on cost competitiveness, sustainability, and delivering the cash for us to be able to invest in other areas. So that was, I think, quite clear strategy for us, where the growth will be and where it will not be.
It's fascinating. I mean, it sounds very much like a where to play and how to win, where do we have a license to win, what can we leverage, but then also putting together a portfolio where the pieces support and sustain one another.
And you know what's important in this kind of industry also internally is that we are very capital intensive. And of course, every business wants to get their share of that capital allocation. And that's a group hat, and that's a group task to decide on that. And I think when you clarify that not everybody will get the same and for what reasons, then the discussions become clear and the criteria becomes clear. So I think that is very helpful, especially when you're looking at growth.
I feel like over the last couple of years, we have all been reminded that the global economy is still very physical. We still make stuff. We have to ship it. Sometimes when you read the headlines, you think that all we do is sort of software and services, and there's a physicality to the global economy.
Yeah.
Does it, as somebody who's been working with wood and now with steel, and you just describe what it takes to extract metal from ores, like, does it sometimes, I don't know if frustrate you or surprise you that people sort of underestimate the sort of physicality, the technicality, the sort of chemistry and physics of some of these essential materials?
Yeah, I've been thinking about the bit from a perspective of metals and mining, because, you know, there's a lot of discussion in the world also of critical minerals. But sometimes also here in Finland, we have like the most sustainable mines in Finland. Like our mine, chromium mine, is almost already carbon free, doesn't use any chemicals, uses gravity, is all the way under the ground in 1 kilometers, all that. But there's still this image of mining being bad. And in that discussion, people kind of forget that if we don't have a lot of the basic things, iron, if we don't have chromium, you know, there's nothing else. All these basic metals elements are actually needed to make plastics, to make whatever you eat today, cement, whatever. And I think that is sometimes that I'm thinking that are we living in such a kind of a, you know, non-physical world that we kind of forget that. And then the discussion that somebody finds is okay, that there's a really bad mine somewhere in the Congo and the product comes from there, we're happy to use it as long as it's not in our country, where we would do it much more sustainably. And you can also create fantastic value chains, of course, around raw materials and kind of increase the value and growth in a country by that. So yes, I see what you are saying. And I think it's especially on this minerals and mining area where I felt sometimes that, hey, are we forgetting something here? So at least I've been reminded about that now a couple of times.
Yeah, I think so. We take our MBA students to visit companies. You know, we usually take them to nice, shiny offices. We got to take
yes.
Deal plans and some mines.
Yes.
And you mentioned AI. Even though it's a physical business, an innovative business, of course, everything is changing. How are you approaching AI? What role does it play in your business? How much time are you spending with AI? How do you get your team to embrace it?
Yeah. No, I think so. It's absolutely a discussion ongoing. It is kind of interesting when you are really looking for operational excellence and that there are areas where we are absolutely quite highly automated and also using AI, like predictive maintenance is a good example of that. You know, energy optimization, when you decide every 15 minutes whether you use energy or you sell it to the market, you can do that between agents. You can optimize a lot of things through AI, through data. I think in our R&D, when you look for the best possible combinations of alloys and steel and different, you know, there you can use it also a lot. I think there's still a lot of opportunities like optimizing across the sites, supply chain, probably asset management as well, you know, asset reliability and what are really the investments you should do where you can sweat some assets and all that. Probably also on a customer area, there are definitely still things we can do. But then on the other hand, we are not a platform, we are not a bank, we are not an insurance company. So we really move a lot of physical product, but it's also some quite technical. So we cannot do customer selling just like we are agents. So we actually are doing consultative selling. When customers have an issue, we say, okay, what kind of metal composition do you actually need to have? So I think industry and heavy industry, I think it's really finding the user cases and the ability then to scale. And I think we are still in the beginning of that journey. And then, of course, you know, like support functions, finance, HR, that is probably where we can go faster. But I would say, no, me and the team, we have not yet worked enough on that. But I can also say that it's very much on the agenda going forward. Absolutely.
You said, you know, you have brought together a team. It was about figuring out who can think strategically. Talk a little bit about bringing together a team, energizing the organization, your own leadership style as you've taken charge of the company.
We in Outokumpu, basically, if you look at our business areas, we have two business areas geographically split. So Europe, stainless steel, America, stainless steel, and then we had ferrochrome. And then we said ferrochrome should become basically a really unrestricted market player. But if you really look at it, it's not that they are really different businesses. And Outokumpu leadership style before me had been more that you have a center, and then from a center you have this business area boards, and that's how you lead. So basically the Outokumpu management team didn't meet that often, or met once a month, but it was a short meeting more to inform each other, but not really the type of your first team management team meeting that I'm used to. So that is also something. Then when I interviewed the Outokumpu leadership team members before I joined, I also got from them the wish to become more of a team and start working more on a group level across. And I also saw that was totally possible because businesses were not different, actually. We could all talk about, we all had a competence to talk about the whole Outokumpu businesses. And that really served me well then when we said that let's start developing the new strategy, because I didn't want to develop it with consultants. I said we can always get consultants in for certain parts if we need that. But we had established then in the past 3 years before me already a small strategy team in Outokumpu that I thought was really good supporting the work. And then we started working as a management team on that. And I think that is something that united the management team, putting really the Outokumpu hat on and saying that, hey, now we have for the first time since long possibility to create the new growth strategy. And these are the decisions we need to make and align together. And I think that was good. And then people got to know each other better, each other's opinions. And then I'm one who allows for the discussion. But at a certain point of time, you need to decide. But I think it was a good process for us as a team, absolutely. And it's something that I also needed.
And then how are you engaging beyond that, the rest of the organization? Are you traveling a lot? Are you visiting sites? Are you enjoying that part of the work?
Yes, indeed. So when I'm here in Helsinki head office, I have every other week a coffee moment with people when I travel to different locations. So I try to have some kind of a town hall, at least a small one, if not a bigger one, and then connecting to people wherever I am. I have a lot of catch-ups on Teams, of course, because I can't always be everywhere. But I think that's super important. And I feel like people quite easily come to me to talk. I think I'm quite approachable, so people are not afraid to come and talk to me and give their opinion, which is, I think, great, because it's not so easy to get feedback also as a CEO. So you have to really ask for it if you want to get it. But I think people have gotten to know me and know that they can approach me quite easily. They don't need to be afraid of that.
Wonderful. You mentioned before the capital intensity of your industry, and you're making commitments for decades. Your successors are going to be bound by some of the decisions that you make right now about capital that you deploy. How do you experience this? I mean, does this weigh on you a lot? Is there a solid process? And so you're very comfortable committing resources over the longer term?
I have not thought about it so much, but I guess I'm quite comfortable because, not that I'm saying that you really need to weigh those decisions. You really need to make sure you think you make good decisions and the investment climate that you're investing in, that you can kind of trust that things don't change. And that's a bit the issue today, that you don't necessarily know whether the regulation or whether the investment climate, the cost base that you think you will have, will stay there. But I have worked my whole life in a capital intensive industries. So maybe that gives the comfort, because I know that you have to think long term. And the funny thing is, actually, when you do organic investments that can be, you know, 100 millions or whatever, 300 millions, it's the thing is not usually the technical side. Usually, you know, the technical side, what the investment will cost, how long it will take, the machines running, whatever, that's not usually the issue. The issue is more on how do you read the market, especially when you're developing new products. So will the market be there? Is your curve of getting to the market, getting the products out, the certifications, all that, is that going to go as you plan? So I see more the challenge on that side, often in these investment cases than... But again, indeed, you need to have certain premises, certain security, and you never have 100% security. So you need to do a lot of scenarios and believe in certain things to be there for 20, 30 years.
And of course, we're at this moment of a lot of geopolitical volatility, right? So some of it is about how is the demand for certain products going to evolve, yeah. But some of it also about, you know, what does the future of the global economy look like? Of course, Finland is a particularly interesting place from which to not just observe this, but to live this, right? With its long land border with Russia, recently joined NATO. I'm wondering if there's something about where you're located geographically and the way, you know, Finnish companies have been operating globally from that base that helps you be comfortable with some of the uncertainty, or that helps you think through different scenarios, or does that play no role?
I don't think it helps you to be more comfortable, but I think it gives you certain depth in discussions, and we work a lot with risks. So, and of course, the current geopolitical situation puts different questions now on the table. If you think investments in Europe, or you think investments in Asia, or you think investments in the US, where you're also asking that, you know, is there anything in a transatlantic relationship that could turn against you? Or if you are in a kind of, for instance, us, if we are developing technology that could be also helping for critical minerals. You know, does that get really political? Do we need to think about where that technology is launched or owned or being developed? So you get kind of questions that you never had before on your table. But then on the other hand, we need to look long term. And then the question, of course, is that what happens after Trump administration? What stays and what maybe gets different? And that's also then we are using external advisors and people that are very much in the U.S. administration also to give their thoughts. Nobody, of course, knows, but to give at least different perspectives on what could happen. And those are the ones we then need to weigh and see that do we see here a bigger risk that would say that, okay, we can't invest now in the U.S. or do we say it's still one of the best places in the world to do business? So those are the discussions maybe we had less before. Yeah. So they are now on the table.
A lot of CEOs I speak with are developing in themselves and with their teams that kind of political acumen where you're trying to understand the political currents a little bit better. You don't know exactly what is going to happen. But in some ways, much like in the past, perhaps you sort of screened out politics and you tried to understand where customer demand is going to be. Now you have to almost pay attention to both things, right? There's what the customers may need, and then there's how the politics might evolve in some of the key places.
And it connects to customers as well, because it's, of course, how does their landscape and possibilities change now with everything around us? So it's not indeed only thinking about us, but thinking about where does our demand go, what happens to our customers. And there, of course, we are somewhat in Europe worried about some of our customer segments staying competitive in Europe. So that is of course, one of the concerns.
One of the issues I wanted to ask about is Ukraine. Is a massive need for reconstruction. Some of that has already started. And you've said that you as a company want to be part of that. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So of course, when the rebuilding after the war would start in Ukraine, then you can imagine that there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be built. Industrial setups need to be built, homes for people. That means also cars, that means home appliances. So stainless steel can play quite an important role there. We have our factories, of course, in Germany, quite close by. We are in Finland connected through the Federation of Finnish Industries to a pro-Ukraine working group, where we are then monitoring what would be the moment for Outokumpu to be more involved or what could we do. So we're definitely following that and do what we can do. Until now, of course, it's been too early. And the people we, for instance, had in Ukraine, we took out of Ukraine because it was not safe enough for them to be in Ukraine. But definitely we'll be following the situation, seeing what we can do to help rebuild Ukraine. And I think stainless steel plays also an important role there.
And is your sense that that's a shared sentiment among some of the CEOs who lead companies that are critical for reconstruction in Europe?
Yeah, absolutely. And definitely, at least from Scandinavia and for Finland, you know, we know what it is to have a war with Russia. So I think there's a lot of empathy from Finland and Finnish companies towards Ukraine. Absolutely.
There's so much on your plate, and it doesn't sound like the world is going to get easier anytime soon. How do you maintain your own energy? What do you do to recharge?
Yeah, I think we need to find our own things. I think I get a lot of energy by being with family, friends around dinner tables, having good discussions. Sports have also been part of my life. That's the way I get more energy, kind of the physical energy, but then also I get my head empty by doing sports. And then I guess as a Finn, I have to say sauna, of course. It's the Finnish mental and physical place to relax. And that's also part of my life, for sure. I have in Netherlands where we live, the first thing we built after renovating the house was the sauna. So
when you go to Finland in the winter, are you one of those people who goes into the 0 degree water as part of that? Or
Not without sauna, but from sauna I do. Yes.
Unbelievable. I did that once and it's going to stay with me forever.
You have to practice. It's a fantastic feeling when you get used to it.
You know, it was my first time. I wouldn't describe it as a fantastic feeling.
I said, you need to get used to it. So
I need to do more of that.
Yes.
Kati Virros, thank you so much for joining us on Leaders Unplugged. It's been great to have this conversation.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Leaders Unplugged is a co-production of IMD and Remote Daily. This episode was produced by Frank Tabouring, Delia Fischer, Felix Seltner, and Rabia Debus. Subscribe to Leaders Unplugged on your favorite podcast platform. I'm David Bach. See you soon.